bit lava to lakes, offering a discovery into what was here before the land we call Minnesota, including sharks, jellyfish, and giant prehistoric fish. Hours and tickets at glaquarium.org.
Good morning. Attorney General Pam Bondi says she's going after states opposed to the president's immigration policies. We'll hear from Washington's Governor Bob Ferguson, who says she doesn't have anything to back it up. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. The Trump administration revoked security clearances for dozens of current and former officials. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. We'll hear from one of them, accused without evidence of violating intelligence standards. Also, how a 23-year-old in Kyiv survived a missile attack that destroyed her apartment and became a national symbol in Ukraine. And are millions of children born during the pandemic ready for kindergarten? It's Thursday, August 21st. On this day in 1959, Hawaii became the 50th state. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. A Russian missile has hit an American electronics factory in Ukraine, causing extensive damage and injuries. This is according to Ukrainian officials. NPR's Greg Myrie reports the attack came as Russia carried out one of its largest airstrikes of the war.
President Volodymyr Zelensky and other officials took to social media to report the airstrike on the U.S. factory. He said a Russian cruise missile slammed into the plant and more than a dozen people were wounded. He did not name the company. Videos show thick black smoke rising from a large industrial plant in the far west of Ukraine near the border with Hungary. Russia attacks western Ukraine less frequently than other areas, but the region was the focus of Russia's overnight barrage that included 570 drones and 40 missiles. This comes just days after President Trump met separately with Zelensky and Russia's Vladimir Putin in a bid to end the war. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Kyiv.
The Texas State House has passed a plan to redraw the state's congressional districts. The GOP plan aims to send up to 5 more Republicans to the U.S. House in next year's midterm elections. This could help the GOP increase its control over Congress. Texas House Democrats, led by Representative Gene Wu, fled the state for 2 weeks to try to block the plan, but many returned. Wu says the redistricting plan is something that will affect all Americans.
This is not over. We will continue fighting. But what needs to happen is we need every American, every Texan, to start paying attention and start learning about how we got here.
The measure has moved to the Republican-led Texas State Senate. California lawmakers will meet today. They're considering a plan to send Democrats to Congress. The White House says more than 550 arrests have been made since President Trump declared a crime emergency in the nation's capital. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports the city's large immigrant population has mixed emotions about the growing operation.
In this largely Latino neighborhood of Washington, D.C., street vendors and food delivery drivers have disappeared. Residents say people are anxious and afraid to go out since ICE and other federal agents started turning up to arrest people.
Yo pienso es muy triste.
It's sad, says Janet Bernal, as she pushes a toddler in a stroller. They work hard, pay their taxes, and are treated badly. She and others do support cracking down on criminals. The White House says some arrested immigrants here illegally have been charged with kidnapping, assault, and burglary. But legal rights groups say some with legal status are also being arrested for minor infractions through traffic checkpoints and roving patrols. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News. Forecasters say Hurricane Erin is slowly pulling away from the East Coast. It has not made landfall, but tropical storm warnings extend from North Carolina's Outer Banks to southern Virginia. Officials are urging people to stay out of the ocean because of life-threatening rip currents. These warnings reach as far north as New England. Local voting officials are leaving their jobs at the highest rate recorded in at least 25 years. NPR's Miles Parks reports the new data show the effect President Trump's falsehoods about voting have had on the profession.
Roughly 40% of the voting officials who oversaw the 2020 election left their jobs before the 2024 cycle. That's according to new research from the Bipartisan Policy Center. Rachel Ori, who leads the center's elections project, says an increase in pressure and harassment have amplified turnover trends that were already happening in the field.
Rising turnover is almost like a canary in a coal mine, indicating that something deeper and more structural in the way that we conduct elections needs to be fixed.
Election officials say this year has been a little quieter when it comes to election denial after Trump's win in 2024, but they expect pressure to pick back up next year ahead of the midterms. Miles Parks, NPR News, Washington.
The annual economic summit that is sponsored by the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City opens today. It's held in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Economists, central bankers, and policy meters will meet there. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell will deliver a highly anticipated speech tomorrow on labor markets. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Betterment, an automated investing platform that strives to make it easy to be invested. Learn more at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
Some of the experiences that I had in Iraq will haunt me for the rest of my life. I definitely wasn't equipped to handle it.
This is Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served, a series exploring the challenges Minnesota's veterans face, as well as the opportunities and services available to them.
My name is Dan, and I was in the Marine Corps. I was in a pretty intense deployment in Ramadi, Iraq. And the first time I saw suicide was on that deployment to Ramadi. And shortly after I got out of the Marine Corps, my younger brother, who was a Marine, he killed himself. I was already struggling with stuff from my deployment and from just the transition out of the military. That just crushed me. I, you know, was into drugs and alcohol and anything to cope, and I took, I don't know how many pills. And I eventually went into treatment. I was at Teen Challenge as well as going to the Minneapolis VA. I decided that I was going to take that pain, take some of those bad decisions, and try to help the people like myself that struggle with that transition.
Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served is produced by AMPRS with support from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, providing our veterans with help. Veterans can find that help online at minnesotaveteran.org.
Morning edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. It's been 36 years since the murders of Jose and Kitty Menendez. Today, a California parole board will begin 2 days of hearings to determine whether their sons who carried out the killings, Eric and Lyle Menendez, should be set free. Steve Futterman reports from San Diego, where the brothers are incarcerated.
The frantic 911 call in August 1989 is still chilling to hear.
Who is the person that was shot?
My mom and my dad.
Your mom and dad?
When they went on trial, the brothers admitted they killed their parents, but said it was in self-defense. The two were eventually found guilty and sentenced to life in prison without parole. Earlier this year, a judge resentenced them to 50 years to life. Under California law, they are now eligible for parole. Today, Eric Menendez will have his hearing. Tomorrow, it will be Lyle Menendez. One of those expected to appear before the board is first cousin Anna Maria Baralt. She supports their release.
We will not stop fighting for Eric and Lyle, for justice, and for the truth.
The most emotional testimony is likely to come from the brothers themselves. While claims of abuse may come up, Loyola Law School professor Lori Levinson says it will likely not be the key factor.
What the parole board has to decide is whether they are suitable, safe for release.
The board will also hear from the L.A. County District Attorney's Office. The current D.A., Nathan Hawkman, does not believe the brothers should be set free.
The Menendez brothers engaged in a deliberate, premeditated killing of their parents.
A decision by the parole board is expected at the end of each day, but even if the board recommends release, it will still be up to California Governor Gavin Newsom, who has the right to veto any recommendation to set them free. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in San Diego.
For months, the Trump administration has been pressuring some states and cities led by Democrats to change their immigration policies. These are places that have adopted so-called sanctuary laws, which bar the use of local resources to support federal agents with immigration enforcement. The Justice Department says these policies run counter to the president's immigration crackdown and that legal action could be next. NPR political reporter Elena Moore is here to give us an update on this. Good morning, Elena.
Good morning, Michelle.
So it sounds like there's been an escalation between the Justice Department and these blue cities and states. What's happening here?
Well, this all connects back to an executive order Trump signed in April, which asked federal agencies to identify jurisdictions that they say obstruct the enforcement of federal immigration laws. It also threatens possible federal funding cuts if changes aren't made. Fast forward to the beginning of the month, the DOJ released a list of 13 states and 18 cities, all run by Democrats, saying they're standing in the way of immigration enforcement. Since then, Attorney General Pam Bondi has really put these places on notice.
You better be abiding by our federal policies and with our federal law enforcement, because if you aren't, we're going to come after you.
So how have state and local leaders responded to this?
Well, we started to see some pretty forceful pushback this week from a handful of state and local leaders who disputed the sanctuary city label and defended their own policies, saying the administration's actions were unjust. One of the strongest rebukes, Michelle, came from Boston's Mayor Michelle Wu during a press conference on Tuesday.
Unlike the Trump administration, Boston follows the law. And Boston will not back down from who we are and what we stand for.
And this came after the DOJ sent letters to Wu and other leaders demanding they change their policies, you know, giving a deadline of Tuesday. And while we're still waiting to see how all 30 jurisdictions on that list respond, we do know that some state leaders, like Washington's Governor Bob Ferguson, have vowed to defend their policies in court if needed.
In the America that I love, have taught my children to revere, we resolve our differences peacefully through public discourse and, if necessary, through the courts.
So now the administration and some of these leaders are all saying that they're gearing up for possible legal action. How might this play out in the courts?
Yeah, well, I mean, pretty soon after Trump's return to office, his administration started taking legal action. And one of the first cases we saw was a lawsuit against Chicago. But the judge in that state threw out the suit, saying the government didn't demonstrate any violation of federal law. But that's not the only case in the works. You know, the DOJ is also suing New York City and Los Angeles using similar arguments. And on the other end, there are several dozen cities and counties across the country that have also signed on to a lawsuit challenging the administration's efforts to withhold federal funding over this issue.
And the administration is, I think people understand, are making this part of a kind of a broader law and order message. You want to talk more about that?
Yeah, well, immigration, as we know, was a central issue in Trump's campaign, and he promised to carry out mass deportations if elected. So this effort by the DOJ is certainly one element of that big pledge. But more broadly, you know, Trump has made issues like crime and safety just big priorities. And that's once again meant picking fights with liberal cities. Just last week, you know, we saw that in Washington, D.C., where we are right now, when Trump deployed National Guard troops to the city and declared a safety crisis, all while signaling, Michelle, that other cities could be next.
That is NPR political reporter Elena Moore. Elena, thank you.
Thank you.
So as Elena just said, one of the letters sent by U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi was addressed to Bob Ferguson. He's the Democratic governor of Washington State, and he forcefully pushed back against the federal government's demands during a press conference on Tuesday.
Let me be very clear. Washington State will not be bullied or intimidated by threats and legally baseless accusations.
When I spoke with Governor Ferguson Wednesday, he rejected the idea that his state's policies get in the way of immigration enforcement.
What we did was in 2019, the Washington State Legislature adopted a bipartisan law that says, hey, for local law enforcement, their focus is on local law enforcement. It's not the job of local law enforcement to do the job of the federal government when it comes to federal immigration enforcement. That's the job of the federal government.
And you're referring to the Keep Washington Working Act?
That's correct.
And does that act limit assistance to the federal government when it comes to enforcing immigration efforts?
Yeah, I mean, our law is carefully balanced. So, for example, there is an exception within the Keep Washington Working Act for our Department of Corrections, for example. The Department of Corrections does notify federal immigration authorities if someone who's undocumented and has been convicted of a felony is being released. That is part of our process here. What the Keep Washington Working Act does preclude is a local police officer or a local state trooper from cooperating with some ICE raid, for example, at a business. We do not cooperate with ICE in any way in that fashion whatsoever.
And why?
That's not our job, right? We have to focus on law enforcement right here. It is not our job to do federal immigration enforcement for them. And that is especially true right now with the outrageous way in which that immigration enforcement is happening every day. We see it on the news, unmarked vehicles, masked agents picking people up off the streets, people being disappeared. That is all totally outrageous and to me is unrecognizable as an American. So it's also worth pointing out, in Pam Bondi's letter to me, she cites no law that says we're in violation of federal law. She cites nothing. It is all posturing. And as a lawyer, it's clear to me that our law is lawful. We follow all applicable federal laws. And that's why I don't think she's going to challenge us in court, because she would lose.
Now, in that letter that you received, Attorney General Bondi said, quote, individuals operating under the color of law, using their official position to obstruct federal immigration enforcement efforts and facilitating or inducing illegal immigration may be subject to criminal charges. How did you take that?
Well, I took that in exactly the way that she meant it, which is a threat to file criminal charges against me and or local police officers or local judges who don't bend the knee to the Trump administration on this issue. And that is, to put it very mildly, that's breathtaking.
Are you willing to risk retaliation from the Justice Department that could include prosecution and imprisonment?
Well, I mean, of course, right? I have a job to do, which is to defend my state and the people of my state, and to do that in a lawful way. But I am reminded, you know, back in 2017, when I was the Attorney General of Washington State, I was the first Attorney General to challenge a Trump administration in court. And I remember picking up my then 7 or 8 year old daughter from school and walking her home. And she'd heard something at school that I might be in trouble because I was doing this with the president. And she asked if I'd be in trouble for doing that. And I told her, Katie, look, we live in this great country where your dad can challenge a president, say things about a president, and stop him from doing something illegal, and your dad does not get in trouble. And that's not how we resolve our political differences. Look, I'd have to have a different conversation with my now 17-year-old daughter, Katie, about that. That's what makes it so breathtaking to me, is a U.S. attorney general threatening a governor, and by the way, other state officials, with prison time for not bending the knee to their agenda when it comes to federal immigration enforcement.
Criminal prosecution is not the only risk here. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm in Washington, D.C., where the federal government has sent in the National Guard. That could happen in your state. Mm-hmm. There's also the possibility of losing federal funding, which I think mm-hmm. makes up, what, 20%?
About 28% of our state budget is federal dollars. That's correct.
So with that, I mean, are you ready for the potential loss of that funding or National Guard coming into your state? And what would you do then?
Obviously, we are preparing for all eventualities, whether it's potential National Guard, and what's happening, by the way, in D.C. is truly outrageous, or the withholding of federal funds. It's all too common right now, the threat of the federal government to withhold funds on all sorts of issues, education funding, public health, FEMA funds, you name it. But at the end of the day, we just can't compromise our values. And that's pretty fundamental to me as governor for the people of Washington State.
Governor Bob Ferguson of Washington State, thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. This is KAXE. You're listening to National Public Radio right here on People Powered Radio. Good morning. Our board of directors meets at 6 o'clock on Monday, August 25th at KPXE in Bemidji. These are open meetings. Members and the general public are invited to attend. For more information, email comments at kaxe.org or call 218-326-1234 during business hours. Regular meetings of our board of directors are held the fourth Monday of the month. Board's meeting schedule is available at kaxe.org. Support comes from Great Lakes Aquarium with its new exhibit, Lava to Lakes, offering a discovery into what was here before the land we call Minnesota, including sharks, jellyfish, and giant prehistoric fish. Hours and tickets at glaquarium.org. Coming up today, we will be getting our news update from news director Chelsea Perkins. We are also, of course, doing our daily dose of phenology. We'll be talking a little bit about the state fair. Malachi Coons and myself are headed down tomorrow to work at the Ampers booth in the education building. KAXE will be represented there all day tomorrow. If you happen to be in the area, we'd love you to swing by and say hello. Now we are just about to hear from Jeff Sundin, our weekly fishing guide, who has a lot of really great updates for us here on the Thursday morning show.
Gone fishing. There's a sign upon your door.
Pops, don't blab it around, will you?
Gone fishing.
Keep it shady. I got me a big one staked out.
You ain't working anymore.
I don't have to work. I got me a piece of Gary.
Cows need milking in the barn.
I have the twins on that detail. Each take a side.
But you just don't give a darn.
Give them 4 bits of cow and hand lotion.
You just never seem to learn.
Man, you taught me.
You ain't got no ambition.
You're convincing me.
Gone fishing. Got your hound dog by your side.
That's old Cindy Lou going with me.
Gone fishing. Fleas are biting at his hide.
Get away from me, boys. You're bothering me. Folks won't find us now because Mr. Satch and Mr. Cross, we gone fishing. Instead of just a wishing.
Bop-a, baby, bop-a, bop-a, bop-a.
Oh, yeah.
You know what that sound means. That means it is time for our early bird fishing guide, Jeff Sundin. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning.
How are we doing this morning?
I just discovered that this is my lucky day because my technology connected itself all by itself without me having to screw up anything.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
Well, that is a good day then. So happy Thursday and happy technology day.
Thank you.
So, Jeff, what's going on? Let's see. Is the water temperature changing yet? I was just out at our cabin last night and was told the water, I didn't go swimming, but was told the water was still really nice and warm. It wasn't too chilly yet.
No, it's still hanging in there pretty good. The sunny day that we had yesterday warmed it up extra. So a lot of the lakes in the region were hanging around 71. 72 degrees. Now, for some reason, I've been on a trend here. Most of this week, I've been hanging out kind of in the Bemidji neighborhood. So I haven't seen what Grand Rapids area lakes or Winnie, some of the bigger ones, have been doing just lately. But in that maybe 30 or 40 miles surrounding Bemidji, I'm seeing the range 70 to 72. And then yesterday, it popped back up to about 75. It was calm and the sun was shining. Those daytime temperatures tend to warm up, but this time of year now we're moving toward just starting to see that trend down. It's not going to warm up and stay warmed up.
Right.
It's moving, inching its way down overnight. And if you get a good sunny day, it warms back up. Then it inches back down again over the next night. And so I think we've seen. I called it wrong here a few weeks ago. I thought we had already seen the peak, and then we got a pretty good warm spell. But this one, now I believe we've seen the highest temperatures of the summer, and we'll start to see them creep down. Now, if you're a swimmer or a boater, water skier, whatever, probably be nice if they stayed up. If you're an angler, and particularly the walleye fishermen that are out there, would probably like to see that trending back down and sure. Get into maybe mid-60s or so, that's the ideal. So we've got a ways to go. The one thing I can tell you, with all of the sunshine and the warm water that we've had lately, we went through a couple weeks where it rained quite a bit. Water levels came up throughout the summer. We started with low water. The weeds grew right to the surface. Then the water levels came up, and we had weed growth that was really robust and, you know, deeper than usual, coming higher to the surface than usual. Now we're seeing that water recede again. It's going down. We haven't had that much rain just lately. So there's a few lakes. There's a couple of lakes, one in particular that has trapped me now a couple of times. If you use the South Landing on Bowstring Lake, the weeds have become so thick in that bay that even if you're going full speed ahead, you have to be careful where you go, because you can get into the weed bed and it clogs up your prop on your motor, and you have to stop right in the middle of the trip and clear everything off and get started. So if you have a chart on your graph so that you can follow the map, set that depth range so that it shows you, you know, a good clear warning at 5 or 6 feet, and then make sure to steer good and clear of that stuff, because particularly the northern milfoil, coontail, tend to grow up to the surface and form a mat. Those can get really tough to get through, and I imagine that it's not dangerous, but it is sort of annoying when you have to stop and clear that stuff off all the time.
Yeah, I've seen those really tall weeds as well. So are basically they like goldfish in that they'll grow to whatever the height of the water is?
I think that's right. They're just occupying as much space as what's available to them. And the growing conditions, we've got so many lakes now that have got clearing water because of zebra mussels and faucet snails, or even in some regions where you don't have any of those invasive species, but we have had half of the summer with really low water and not a lot of inflow from low-lying, swampland or anything like that. So that water stayed clearer than usual, and the weed growth grow a lot more than usual when there's all kinds of sunshine. Just like, you know, your garden or the grass in the yard or whatever, you give it the perfect growing conditions and it seems like it goes kind of out of control for a while. So aside from navigation and swimming and things like that, I've noticed one of the irksome things that's going on this summer is that we've got more weeds than ever growing in deeper places than ever, but on a lot of lakes, the fish still like where the old weeds used to be. So in order, let's say that you've got a lake where the weed growth is coming up to 13, maybe 14 feet deep, and you can see it on your sonar. They're pretty easy. You know where that outside edge of the weed line, but the fish are up in 8 or 9 feet of water where the old weed line used to be. So in order to catch the fish, you have to stop worrying about where the edge of that weed growth is and focus instead on that entire level drop off and go in a little bit shallower. So even if you're seeing weeds in 14 feet of water, you still may want to be fishing in 8, 7, 8. And it's a little tangly and so on and so forth, but you can make it happen on most of the lakes. Just keep that in your back pocket as a tip. If you think you should be fishing the weeds, you probably should. And you just might have to go up a little shallower than you're expecting.
Okay. They trust what they know. That's a lot of people can relate. So let's move into talking a little bit about season changes. What are you seeing as some early signs of some fish migration?
Not seeing a ton with the walleyes just yet. They're kind of hanging in there. Midsummer, if you want to call it doldrums, we'll come circle back to that in a minute. But the panfish are starting to show in some signs. Yesterday, I actually saw some decent-sized schools of crappies that had come completely out of the weeds and were kind of out in the open water. Now, the early part of the fall, the fish, even though the water temperature hasn't gone down that much, the weeds are still green mostly, but there is this kind of a influence for the fish to move out away from the weeds and start gathering. If you fish a lake that's got a little bit deeper water, a hole in it, and that hole, the drop-off, the places where that comes up as close to the shore as you can find, those tighter, what we call inside corners where the deep water comes up adjacent to the shoreline, those are the type of holes to start watching first. So weeds are nearby. You've got a big weed flat and this little inside corner where the deep water comes up to the shore, and start watching that break line where the adjacent weed bed and the deep water meet. And maybe 15, 18, could be as deep as 20 feet of water sometimes. Kind of watch around and you'll start to see these schools of fish now gather up. And we noticed yesterday, because the water is still warm, your instinct on fall panfish is to try and find these schools and then stop, fish vertically or use slip floats or something like that, kind of nice slow approach. Now that was working over the past few days a little bit, but with that warm water, the fish still want to see something moving pretty quickly. So we've been finding that if we troll with spinners or keep a pretty good pace, maybe 1 mile an hour, 1.1, something like that, and use plastic tails that have a good amount of action, like a good wiggly twister tail or a paddle tail that's soft plastic that has a lot of action, the fish seem to prefer seeing something moving fast right now than they do moving slow. Same thing with the sunfish. We're seeing those gather up too. And I stopped yesterday over what I thought was a school of sunfish, and we did the typical put a small jig with a chunk of a cut piece of night crawler on it, drop it over the side. Now, for me, it was working fine. I could catch the fish doing that, but they were sort of picky and popping at it, and my crew was having a little bit of trouble with that. And even with the sunfish, we started to troll the spinners through those, just swap out, instead of putting a minnow on the hook, just put a small leech or about a half of a night crawler, and then troll through those sunfish had a pretty good clip, and they were a lot more active and biting that way. The only trick was for crappies, stay a little higher in the water column. They tend to be suspended 4 or 5 feet maybe above the bottom, and for sunfish, get down a little bit closer, stay within a foot or two of the bottom, and you'll be able to just, it's almost like magic. You can go through the same area using two modifications of the same presentation and single out which one of those fish species you want to catch.
So Jeff, if you're fishing for sunnies, does going deeper help you get the bigger sunfish instead of the little, you know, the small ones that get on the line all the time?
It does not.
Okay.
Nope, I'm sorry, Carrie. It just doesn't. The secret there is to figure out where the schools of fish are. Now, it was interesting. Yesterday, the exact scenario you're talking about, one school of fish that we found was like carbon copy, all just perfect size, 8.5, some 9-inch size fish, just ideal keeping size fish. And then, so now I think I've got the pattern figured out. So I go and find another school of fish. Now all of the fish are 6-7 inches, just a little bit too small to be interesting. So the secret is, just because you're catching fish, if they're not the ones that you're looking for, you have to go away. The old people used to say, don't ever leave fish to find fish. But, the truth of it is, you can leave a certain size of fish and go find a different size of fish and be a little bit happier. So location is probably more of a thing. Now, occasionally, if you're on a lake where there's tons of stunted sunfish, and it's hard to get through them, but you know there's a few nicer ones in there. Occasionally, dropping something down and getting it right to the bottom will help you, but more often than not, I've found that if you're really trying to single out a larger size fish, making them come up to find you works better than going down and trying to fight toe-to-toe with all the little stuff that's down there. So maybe a better idea is to use a larger bait that the small ones have trouble getting, and then single out the big ones by forcing them, you know, keep it up 5 or 6 feet above the rest of the fish and make the big ones come up, put a just a nicer, larger, more attractive bait for them, for the larger fish, and that might be a way to go on some of those stunted panfish type lakes.
Okay. So let's talk about your experience lately with walleye. They've been tricky.
Well, they're making a lot of people pull their hair out right now. This is another thing with the, believe it or not, the trouble isn't that they're not biting. The trouble is that they're biting so well that they really don't need us for anything. The lakes are, the water is still warm as it's ever going to be. The weeds are great. The fish can make a 45-minute run and feed all they want to feed and be done and full for the day. And so people are reporting being able to see them on the graph but not get them to bite and so on and so forth. If you really want to get serious about catching walleyes here for the next little while, I think the real trick is to just stop worrying about them for most of the day. Maybe put the boat in the water around 5, 6 o'clock in the evening and fish until dark or maybe an hour past dark, especially on some of the clear water lakes. I've been fishing with some folks that are staying on Cass Lake, and the reports over there, you can go out and find fish. You can see them sometimes in the daytime, but not catch very much. Go out and fish that last 3 hours of evening and into the night and have no problem. So a lot of folks staying at the resorts over there have kind of become hip to the idea of trolling crankbaits on the big, large flats and do that as the sun goes down. They're catching fish without too much trouble at all. So for the next maybe week to 10 days, something like that, kind of focus on that evening. And I think it's better to focus on the evening than the morning. During the morning, it seems like you have fish that have fed heavily overnight, and it's no particular advantage to be out real early in the morning. After the evening comes and they've been sitting still and not feeding much throughout the entire day, that little spurt that you get at dusk seems like a better, stronger pattern to capitalize on. Now, we'll see coming up here, we're going to have a full moon before too long, another 10 days or so. And as we approach that full moon, you'll see an uptick in the action. The water temperatures will drop a little bit. The fish will start to get a little bit more active. And everybody is going to think, aha, here we go. This is the fall bite starting up. And for maybe a week or 10 days, the fishing action should get pretty good. Then we'll see one more taper off where it gets slow again for a while. And then the next time after that, when we get the next dip down in water temperatures, that'll be the beginning of fall. So hold on tight and start planning ahead, because this is all, we're coming to probably the best fishing time of the year. It's just going to be a couple more weeks.
So on that note, with preparing for good fishing, there is the DNR announced that Mille Lacs walleye limit will go up starting in just a couple days.
That's the good news.
Okay. And it will go up to 3 fish, is that right?
They've had it at 2 now for a while, and folks have remembered, you know, it's been for years, it's been either at 0 or occasionally 1. So a move up to 3 fish. For people who can catch those fish, that is probably really cool, because you could go out on an evening and, you know, come home with a few walleyes to eat. There's still a pretty restrictive slot limit, so that it's not going to be automatic or easy to catch those fish. The bad news about this is the reason that they're moving it up to 3 fish is because the harvest has been really low throughout the summer. And the reason that the harvest is low is that people have been really struggling to catch fish. So it's a, you know, kind of a good news, bad news scenario. If you can find them and if you're a good enough angler to be able to catch them, yes, you'll be able to harvest a few fish, but don't expect it to be an easy thing to go out and do. Now, one of the things about when we talk about walleyes and whether they're biting, easy to catch or hard to catch, the lake pretty much has a great walleye population in it, despite what some people will say. There's plenty of fish in the lake. The trouble is the balance between how many predators and how much prey. And it's amazing, the teeter-totter, the shift in the balance only has to be a few percent. Like fisheries biologist and outdoor writer Dick Sternberg, we had a fantastic conversation about this maybe 25 years ago. And he explained to me like a 3 to 4% shift, if there's a little bit too many bait fish in a lake so that the walleyes have whatever they want, whenever they want it, it can seem like fishing is impossible. It can be like the Dead Sea. The shift balance goes the other way a little bit, and now the predators in the lake are a little on the hungry side because there's not quite as much prey available to them. They have to work a little harder and spend more time to get a good meal. Now, that's when you hear about one of these lakes where it's the hot bite of the season and the fishing is on fire. So instead of pointing fingers and kind of worrying about who took too many or who didn't take enough, so on and so forth, watch this balance and keep your eyes on your graph. A lot of times we've got all the information. You like to fish a lake. You see tons of bait fish every place you go. That could be a warning sign that you're in for a little tougher fishing. Maybe you should research and poke around and see about some other lakes that are in the area and shift your attention that way for a little while. So a good way to do is to think of a good fishing spot is always a good fishing spot. And if there's plenty of fish, there'll be fish on it. But it starts with picking the right lake. You have to get the lake where the balance is just about right. You know, a little predator, you can kind of sometimes tell if the walleyes all look fat and super healthy, that's telling you they got plenty of food. You go to a lake and maybe they look a little more skinny, not so plump. That might be a place to target for a little while.
All right, Jeff, before we go, let's briefly talk about some last minute opportunities to getting kids out fishing maybe before the school year begins.
Yeah, the Labor Day weekend coming up. Well, as long as these water temperatures are staying warm, I kind of like this. I like this weed pattern and trolling. The spinners always produces some fish. There's a good mix right now of small bass and northern pike and rock bass, sunfish, crappies. I had an experience. I was fishing with some kids, and their parents come from Indiana, and we were catching tons of fish, and the kids were all excited about it. Little bass was kind of like the main thing, and there's nothing wrong with stopping and catching some bass and bringing a few of the smaller ones home and eating them. The kids were totally excited. We've got bass in the live well. The mom is excited, the dad is excited, the kids are excited, everybody's going to have a big fish fry. And then we tell grandma that we've got these bass, and she goes, ooh, bass. And now, all of a sudden, all four of those people, the whole family that was all excited before, now they're all upset because now they think we've got fish that grandma didn't approve of.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're taking your kids fishing, do yourself a favor. If you want them to keep going and you want them to take you fishing later on in your golden years, make sure that you let them have some fun. And believe it, there's nothing wrong with eating a few bass. They taste just fine. I would recommend keeping the smaller ones, not the larger ones. Do a nice job of cleaning them and so on and so forth. We'll talk more about this down the road, but you got to let kids enjoy themselves a little bit. Don't transfer your idiosyncrasies onto them unless you want them to grow up and be like you.
Well, you know what, Jeff? I was a camp counselor, and that was the number one rule for us was even if you don't think it's going to be great, you got to put on a good face because your attitude translates directly to those children. So thanks for that. Sure. We'll talk more on that later. This has been your Early Bird Fishing Guy, Jeff Sundin. You can find more at jeffsundin.com. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you. We'll see ya.
See you later. This is the Thursday morning show, and it's time for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. On St. Lawrence Island in the Bering Sea, the remote village of Savunga has long struggled with limited jobs and food security. A new reindeer processing facility hopes to help change that. KNOM's Wally Rana visited the site to learn more about how the development could benefit the community while also connecting Savunga with its history.
Just steps away from the crashing waves of the Bering Sea, a new structure rises beside the sandy beach. Workers from Finnish construction company Comatose hammer and drill away on the rooftop of the facility. The company specializes in modular food processing facilities and is working alongside local hires from Savunga. The workers are putting the finishing touches on a large white facility destined to become the village's new reindeer processing plant. Benjamin Pengawi is the president of the Savunga Tribal Council. He says the new facility will kick off a number of opportunities for the village of 800.
I'm making hope that if we expand over the decades, we would hopefully bring in some employment from the Nome area and some of the villages. That some of the funds that, if they accumulate, we could start a little youth camp.
The facility will be run by the Savunga Reindeer Commercial Company, or SRCC. The history of reindeer in Savunga goes back over a century. When a Presbyterian missionary brought a small herd to the island, the herd grew and eventually migrated east to what would become Savunga.
The herd wanted to linger on the east side because of the food abundance, and the initial herders thought that they should send four apprentices to watch the reindeer. And those four men looked at Savunga. From there, they start getting their relatives to move in.
Over a century later, Pengawi says the facility aims to carry the legacy forward by creating jobs, supporting food security, and keeping reindeer at the heart of Savunga's identity.
So we're hoping to bring up a little island employment, both villages. You know, the younger generation could continually benefit from that.
Once operational, the U.S. Department of Agriculture will inspect the facility. If approved, reindeer produced in Savunga could earn the coveted USDA-certified label. The designation lets customers know that animals were raised appropriately and are safe to eat. In Savunga, I'm Wally Rano.
For over a century, the Santa Fe Indian Market has been a spotlight for some of Indian country's most talented artists to shine. From crafts to fashion, as KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, 1,000 juried artists from more than 200 tribes descended upon New Mexico over the weekend.
What's so great about Santa Fe Indian Market is that you can meet the artists, and that supports so many livelihoods.
Among them was Naomi Glasses and her brother Tyler.
It's a good time to just go out and find pieces that speak to you.
They're both Diné and just released a new collection this week with Polo Ralph Lauren.
I'm over the moon about it, doing cartwheels and flips inside. I'm excited for it to get out there in the world and for everyone just to see what this whole collection is about.
His sister, Naomi, was named the company's first artist in residence in 2023.
I'm fortunate enough to be able to collaborate with companies that I'm able to design something and then they're able to manufacture it. I also still do my beautiful handwoven goods that I sell at markets like Santa Fe.
She says if you love wearing native art, buy directly from indigenous designers.
Authenticity is what really matters, and I really hope that more companies learn from the model that we did with Polo Ralph Lauren. I really want to see more of that.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Quahonic Broadcast Corporation, funded by the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You are listening to the Thursday morning show. I'm Kari Hedlund, filling in for Heidi Holton. Malachi Coons joins me now. Good morning, Malachi.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
Yeah, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. I saw right away when I pulled up our text sign when I walked in, I saw we had a message that 60 years ago yesterday, the Beatles were in Minnesota for their one and only show. I don't know if you saw that. But
I saw that this morning.
This is from Liberty and Faustin. She said her grandma and her cousin were 13 years old and got to see them. I had just seen, I don't know what news organization had posted a similar, you know, it's been 60 years since the day. And apparently the Beatles took their first sauna. They were staying in the Twin Stadium or not the Twin, whatever it was.
Yeah, the Met.
Stadium. The Met. It, yes. Yes. And I guess I was reading this story and one guy there got assigned to like monitor the Beatles, take care of them. They were using the Twins dressing room as kind of their dressing room and they were putzing around and he asked them if they wanted to take a sauna and they said, yeah.
There was a sauna in the Twins dressing room or locker room.
I guess.
I love that.
Doesn't that seem
so
like
Minnesota?
Fitting?
Yes.
Yeah. Anyways.
So they must not have a lot of Finnish influence. They must not have had a lot of Finnish influence in the UK.
Yeah, you know, I was wondering about that as well. I could see that, especially if you grew up in a big city.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean,
I feel like other places have some form of like getting really hot
steamy
in their culture. But, you know, the Brits are kind of stiff.
And then that's true.
That's a generalization. I'm sorry if anyone, if anyone's listening, but. I mean, anyways, it was an interesting story. Yeah, I didn't even know I had never heard that they had come to Minnesota in the first place.
Did you grow up with saunas?
No. So
neither. Me neither.
Yeah, my parents are not of Scandinavian heritage, and you know, southern Wisconsin is closer to Iowa where I grew up than Minnesota even. So there wasn't really one around. I have vivid memories of going up north one year, and we all just. Sauna, right. jump in a lake, and kind of loved it, but they weren't common.
Before I moved here, my only experience was in like hotels, which are usually like kind of the worst saunas because they can't, you know,
yeah.
It's just the way it's used. It's just not possible to have it be a really great sauna. And so that was really my only experience was when if we would ever stay in a hotel that had a pool.
Okay.
There would maybe be one, but I did not experience much or really even care for them until I moved here.
Yeah, it was definitely an acquired taste, but now it's something that I do cherish.
Same.
And I wonder if the Beatles brought it home.
Yeah, maybe Paul still does it. Do you think Paul, I mean, think of that life that they've lived, like, especially in particular, Paul. Like, Ringo, of course, still has played a lot, but Paul is on, like, you know.
Sounds like you're dissing Ringo.
No, I'm not. I'm talking about what I'm talking about is,
yeah, where are you
just
going
throwing me under the bus here? Do you think Paul or Ringo like remember those things? Think of how many shows they've played in their life. But like, you know, wondering if they remember like, man, we played in Minnesota that time and we had a sauna. Like, do you think that ever comes up in conversation?
That's a really good question. I mean, I would assume that is like,
is it?
out of the norm enough that maybe it would stick in your mind at that time.
That's what
but
I was meaning.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, so I would assume that, and it's sort of a memorable experience.
Yeah.
It's not like, I don't know.
Especially if they took it home with them and they're like, I love saunaing now.
Yeah. I bet they do. If I ever get the chance to interview Paul McCartney, mark my words.
You will ask.
Yeah.
That's a good question to ask actually.
Yeah. 60 years ago. Anyways.
Were you there? Text us 218-326-1234 60 years ago.
Yeah, was anyone
the Beatles?
Yeah, was anyone else at that show? We also heard from Steve. Had the same thing. It was that thing in the hotels next to the hot tub. Which okay, I do remember that as well.
And they were always like dry saunas, which is also you know like where you couldn't steam it because I'm sure people would put like pop on it or soda or something. You know, people are just dumb.
I know.
In hotels.
I know. And people love to experiment as well,
exactly.
Even though they're dumb. I like to give people a little more credit. Maybe because I've put weird things on saunas before.
Okay.
But yeah, dry sauna doesn't do it for me.
No. All right. You are listening to the Thursday Morning Show today. We've got Chelsea Perkins will be stopping by and telling us what the news team has been up to. We've got best wishes next hour. And Malachi and I are headed to the State Fair tomorrow to work at the Ampers booth for KAXC. if you happen to be in the area or on the fairgrounds, you should swing by and say hi.
Yeah, we're going to be hanging out throughout a lot of the day. Come chat with us. We're going to be doing a giveaway, going to be having some fun. We're also going to host On the River live from the fair. So if you want to see us in action or inaction.
Or come, you can even get on the mic and talk to us if you want.
Yeah, that'd be awesome, actually. We should have some check-ins about things you've eaten, things you've seen at the fair. There's going to be live music. Davina and the Vagabonds, we're going to miss her because she's playing while we're going to be doing our show. But if you're down there, check that one out and come report to us.
Exactly.
We're
it's really close.
Delegate reporters.
The Lining Kugels band shell is really close to the education building, so be sure to swing by.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too. Support for KAXE comes from Lady Sippers NA Bottle Shop, located in downtown Deer River, Itasca County's only NA bottle shop, offering ready-to-drink options, ingredients for craft cocktails, gifts, and more. Info available at ladiesippers.com.
Support also comes from the Lake Country Journal, a magazine showcasing the beauty, landscapes, and people of Lake Country. The February-March issue publishes the winners of their annual photo contest, which are also displayed at the Brainerd Lakes Regional Airport. Submissions accepted all year round at lakecountryjournal.com.
Tonight, the United Way of Bemidji is hosting a wine and beer tasting social from 4:30 to 7:30 at the Sanford Center. You have to be 21 years or older to attend. The event includes live music, a silent auction, and a raffle. Tickets are available at unitedwaybemidji.org.
Right now, it is 60 degrees here in Grand Rapids. Sunny skies. It is looking pretty similar around the area. Going to have another nice day here in northern Minnesota. A mix of sun and clouds. There's a chance for a stray shower or thunderstorm, but highs in the low 80s. Tonight, though, thunderstorms during the evening, gusty winds, even possible hail. So a beautiful day here. Some weather, rain, and thunder coming our way this evening.
It's time for the set list here on KAXE.
This is The Set List, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at shows Friday and Saturday, August 22nd and 23rd, near Itasca State Park, in Bemidji, Walker, and Grand Rapids. Starting things off with the Mississippi Headwaters Music Fest in Itasca Township this Friday and Saturday. Located not far from Itasca State Park, the festival's Friday lineup includes Forge North, The Bad Decisions, and more, with music beginning at 3 p.m. On Saturday, the Lydia Rose Band, Kitschy Boogie, and others are playing with music beginning at 12:30. The specific address can be found online. It's Mississippi Headwaters Music Fest this weekend. Also Friday night, Sam Miltich and the Clearwater Hot Club will be at Bridges in Bemidji at 6 p.m. Playing the hot club jazz of Django Reinhardt alongside straight-ahead tunes and Balkan folk music. The group feature original songs alongside jazz standards and folk traditionals. Sam Miltich and the Clearwater Hot Club Friday night at Bridges in Bemidji. On Saturday, country and folk icon Steve Earle is coming to the Northern Lights Casino in Walker. Active since the mid-70s, Earle has 7 Grammy-nominated albums, winning 3 of them, and is best known for songs like Copperhead Road, Guitar Town, Galway Girl, and many more. Most recently, he continued a series of cover albums with a tribute to Jerry Jeff Walker in 2022. The opener is country singer Calder Allen. It's Steve Earle at Northern Lights Casino in Walker this Saturday at 6. At the same time, folk rock quartet Morning Bird are playing Rapids Brewing in Grand Rapids. Led by multi-instrumentalist Jill Burks and Josh Palmy, the group is rounded out by the rhythm section of Shane Kingsland and Jim Pedala. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.